You're listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
Welcome to UCB Long-Form Conversations Podcast from Los Angeles. I'm Londo Theus Jr. I was a guest in the last episode, but today I'm the host, baby, baby. And my guest today is Tara Copeland, who improv fans, you might know from the legendary UCB New York team Mother, and currently Magic to Do at UCB Sunset Musical Improv Show, and Gravid Water, which there's another show coming up in August.
Yes, that correct? The first Sunday of every month, Gravid Water, first at Sunday. The Franklin Theater.
Now, how did you, let's talk about Gravid Water, since that's the thing that came up.
Oh.
How did you get involved with that show?
I mean, I started doing it in New York. I lived in New York for 14 years before I moved to LA. And when Stephen Ruddy, he's the one who created the show and directs the show. I mean, gosh, 7 years ago, maybe he started doing it, and he did some like test run of it in Brooklyn somewhere that I wasn't a part of. And then when they got the run at UCB, he asked me to be in it, and I'd known him for a while and coached him in a group. And so he asked me to do it, and it's one of my favorite shows of all time to do. Have you seen it?
I have seen it. Yeah. I remember I saw you in it one time at UCB Franklin.
Oh, yeah.
And it was such an amazing experience because I think I was still like in class at that point. So I'm just thinking about improv and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the thing that I found watching that was like almost everybody who was an actor who had rehearsed lines, they seemed like the unusual ones in the scene. Like, it was just like, man, theater is crazy when you look at plays if it's out of a certain context. So it was so interesting watching the improvisers basically straight man the scene, but the improvisers were so funny, just making sense and putting context to everything that the actor was saying.
It's the ultimate exercise in justification. For people who don't know, Gravid Water is a show where one person, an actor, has memorized their half of a pre-written scene, like a real scene from a play or a movie, and they act it opposite an improviser who doesn't know what it is. Not necessarily has never seen or heard it, because I've definitely been in some before where I'm like, I know what this is, where you start to recognize it after a while, but you don't know what it is ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So you're just improvising and they can't veer from the script, which is, they're always like backstage so nervous beforehand, like trying to make sure I memorize it. I always say to them, they won't know. If you forget a line, no one's going to know.
Yeah. That's great.
It's a really fun show. And it's the first Sunday of every month at UCB Franklin.
Okay, great. So improv fans, check that out.
Make sure
it's an amazing experience.
Yeah.
Now, let's just talk about a little origin story.
Sure.
When did you first come in contact with improv, and what about it made you want to continue with
it? I had two first experiences, and one was in high school. We did like forensics competitions. I'm from Arkansas. We'd go around the state, and you'd like prepare a scene, or you'd you would compete in a competition, basically. And improv was one of the categories. And I wasn't scheduled to compete in that category, but one of my friends was with another girl, and the other girl got really, really sick and couldn't go. And so she was like, will you do this with me? So I must have had an understanding of what it was, but I don't. We watched Whose Line Is It Anyway? The British version on Comedy Central with my dad. It was one of his favorite shows. So I knew what improv was to some extent because I did it. And we ended up placing fourth in the statewide competition.
Oh, wow.
So I had it in my head like, oh, that was really fun. And then when I was a freshman in college in 1995, if you don't do the math, I went and saw an improv show at my college, and I really describe it almost like a movie moment of like, I literally was like, that's me.
Mm-hmm.
That's me. I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. You know? And I had never any doubts that that's what I was supposed to be doing from the minute I saw it. I was like, that is who I am on stage. And so I auditioned and, you know, was like, whatever, got in as a freshman. And so I did it all 4 years of college and went, went and did it in the summers in New York between college sessions. And then as soon as I graduated, I moved to New York to do improv.
Interesting. Now, at that time, because, I mean, even now I'm curious, like, when you go somewhere to do improv, it doesn't seem like that's something you can make a living at.
No.
So especially coming from Arkansas and moving to New York and doing it, what about it was like, I know I can do this, I'm pursuing this, and I can make a life out of this?
I mean, I guess I didn't know if I could make a living doing it. Mm-hmm. I just knew that that's what I wanted to do with my life, even if, and you know, in New York, I had a day job for 10 years. And, but my life was improv and teaching improv. Another thing is that I had an internship at a theater in New York, an improv theater that had a touring company. Mm-hmm. And so one of my first very earliest dreams was to be in that touring company because I knew that I could make money doing improv. And I did. I was in that group for 6 years and I ended up on the main stage of that show. So there was like a little bit of time early on when I really was like paying my rent doing improv, you know, and I was on a Herald team at UCB and I was in this touring company and that's sort of what I was, it was all I was doing with my life was that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, now I teach improv for a living. So, I that's really nice not to have to have my desk job during the day. I can make a living teaching it. Uh-huh. But it was like, you know, I was in my early 20s and doing improv for a living, which was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you find the process of training and learning improv and studying improv and just some of the, you know, some of the ups and downs that every student faces about, you know, self-doubt and how to grow and how to get to the next, you know.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I've been listening to your podcast and hear, you know, and I hear those stories all the time of like which levels make you doubt yourself and stuff like that. And I was thinking, even on the car ride over here, I was listening to more of your podcast and I was like, I never had that. Mm-hmm. I always knew that that's what I was supposed to be doing, and I was always really funny and good at it. I never had like moments of self-doubt. Back then, I would say like 1999 to 2003, I was doing so many improv groups. I mean, I was in like, you know, I was taking three classes at two different theaters. I was, understudying for that touring company. I was on a Herald team. And my Herald team, we used to rehearse twice a week and have a show once a week for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I was just doing it all the time. And so there definitely were probably moments of like, ugh, like, they, you know, this is not old, but just a little bit like overwhelming. And maybe you have this experience, but like I was in groups that were terrible and I was in groups that were great, but you know, where you were just like, this is like such a waste of my time. Yeah. But I was in that headspace of like, nothing is a waste of my time. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try and do every single thing I can possibly do. So I was just doing improv like it was my job, even though it wasn't paying me anything and costing me probably a ton of money. Although I was interning at UCB and at this other theater and, you know, I was like really probably not spending a ton of money actually. But I took a class, I can't remember if it was level two or three, and I lived in Brooklyn and the class was at 9 a.m. on Sunday mornings. And so I used to get up and get on the subway at 8 o'clock in the morning to go take an improv class in the city. So it was, you know, at that time, the dedication to it was really different and really interesting. But I have to say, like, I never had a moment where I was like, this is hard or self-doubt. Mm-hmm. But back then, it was taught really differently than it is now in some ways. Like the curriculum hadn't been created yet at UCB and we were just, I guess we're like, everyone was making it up as we went along. I mean, they were just starting out. UCB was a brand new thing. My first ever class at UCB was before they had a theater. It was in 1997. I think I was 19 or 20 years old, and I was living in New York for 5 weeks and just seeing as many shows and interning at this other theater. And I wish I could remember every second of it now, but it was a women-only workshop for 3 hours on a Sunday afternoon, mm-hmm. taught by Tina Fey.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it was before Tina Fey was Tina Fey. And it was, I moved a flight in order to take it because I was flying home to see my family. I was supposed to fly that day. I moved my flight so I could take the class. And that night, Garth Brooks was performing in Central Park. And I was like, I have to stay to watch Garth Brooks in Central Park. Yeah. And so I flew out the next day. And I took all my suitcases and stored them at Solo Arts because they didn't have a theater yet while I took the workshop. And it was amazing. It was amazing. Like, I already knew I loved improv, but it was the first time I had an improv class that was not about gimmicky stuff. Like, I had taken a comedy sports workshop at one point, and it was very much about, like, how to go for a funny thing and how to pretend that you're failing in order to get a laugh and, like, stuff like that. Like, very gimmicky stuff. And this was the first one that was just about, like, scene work. And then on top of that, it was women only, and it was just super amazing. It was an amazing experience.
How important was that, and how was your experience being a woman in improv at that time? Because I know, even especially now, there's just a tendency to be more men on stage than that. And so I know back then it probably was even tougher.
There weren't a lot of us, and a lot of us are still doing it today. A lot of the women are still doing it today who, like, sort of made the cut back then. But it was like every Herald team had one or two women on it. And, you know, it was sort of like that was the math ratio. I feel like a diva. I never had any problems as a woman. I maybe it's just partially like who I am, or I went to an all women's college. And so maybe I had a different mindset, but I was in a co-ed sketch and improv group in college. Cause we shared a course guide with a co-ed college. So our improv group was co-ed, but I don't know. It was never hard. It was never part of my struggle. You know, my struggle with being a woman mostly happened off stage. It is never something that happened with me, and I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I've thought a lot about it over the years. Like, why didn't I ever feel any of that? I used to joke, it's because no one's attracted to me, so there's no weirdness. They don't treat me weird. They never make me a prostitute because they would never think about having sex with me in the first place. But you know, I mean, I didn't know that I should be thinking about things like that. I was just doing this thing that I loved so much, you know. Mm-hmm. So I really think I've always had like an unusual place of sort of confidence and security about improv that I know not everybody has experienced.
Mm-hmm. Is there any, do you find difficulty, especially as a teacher, if you have students that come up to you and have difficulties in that space? Do you find difficulty in trying to relate or trying to give advice to that?
I don't. I address it a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. So just because I never actually went through it, I know exactly what it is, and I see it. And I see it with women in class all the time. And I actually am really direct about it. Like, even in level one, I think I said to a student just this week, like, you're just being just too nice. Mm-hmm. You're not letting yourself shine at all in the scene, because and I see that with women more than men. Mm-hmm. I see women sort of take a more supporting role more than men. And so I will, even in level one, I'll say, here's a little soapbox for you women. I'm not going to let you do that. I'm going to make you play aggressively. I'm going to let you, I'm going to really give you some tricks to not fall into that pattern. And it's not just women, but it's women more than men. And it's like, I don't know, English people too. I've had like a thing where they love to ask questions and really understand you. I'm like, be more assertive, make more I statements, play with more feeling, like, you know, like, and so just cause I didn't exactly go through it doesn't mean I haven't recognized it. Mm-hmm. I was lucky too. I'm in an all female improv group called Miss Jackson, and we've been together since like 2001. And I always had that group too. And it was an interesting thing because people would say like, oh, you felt like you you guys felt like you needed to put an all women's, like an all female group together. And we were like, no, like Jessica Eason started that group of just like, here's five people I really, really want to play with. And she wasn't thinking about it as women versus men. It had no political aim really, but as we sort of grew and got better and better, that was actually a real part of what we were thinking about more and more, is like the strength of this group of women together. Mm-hmm. So it ended up being this like nice byproduct of that, and mm-hmm. without being the intent of it.
Was there anything that you felt playing with Ms. Jackson that kind of unlocked a certain type of play that you would do? Because I know for me, When I was a part of like an all black group, yeah. all of a sudden I started playing a little differently, and there were certain scenes and certain stuff that would come out of me.
Yeah, you know what I think? Probably it unlocked a lot, and it's not going to be the same thing. But like playing, we had to play men, mm-hmm. I play really, really funny men, and I didn't know that, because I think that you put yourself in a role that you're familiar with and comfortable with. And I think that's good, especially when you're first learning. It's important to have your own perspective and have your own truth, right? Mm-hmm. But to be like, oh, I can play lots of different things that it maybe has never occurred to me to play before. And then to bring that back to my other groups mm-hmm. was, I think, really good. I mean, how many times have you seen a scene where a woman steps out and you can tell from the audience that she's a man, mm-hmm. and then she gets labeled a woman because the other person can't see it, right? Mm-hmm. And that happens. I'm sure that happens to you. It happens all the time. If you have an older student in class, they get labeled the mom or the dad or the grandma like all the time. And mm-hmm. so trying to constantly be like, put a more blank slate on this and like play, I don't know, you can play so much more imaginatively and creatively than like the only thing that you see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing that seems to be synonymous with your name is I hear musical improv. Yeah. The next name I hear is Tara Copeland.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me about not only how important musical improv is to you, but yeah. when did that first start in your life?
Well, the touring company I was in did musical improv. We did a, you know, it was a short form show, but it was funny because it had elements that were not short form. And one of them was that we ended the first act of every show with a 20-minute musical where we would interview an audience member about their day or something going on in their life. And then we would make up a musical about them. So, I mean, that, like, I always did that from that was one of the first things that I knew how to do, because I was in that group at the same time as I was doing UCB. And a lot of people that that you know that are comedy people were in that group. And I think that, you know, there, I don't know, it's so fun. It's so freeing to do musical improv. And I have out of body experiences mm. sometimes when I'm on stage and musical improv is happening in a way that I don't with regular improv, where I'll just like really honestly just start laughing and be like, I can't believe this is happening. Like, yeah. I can't believe this is real. You know, people often don't think it's improvised. They're, mm-hmm. you know, they can't believe that we're really making it up. Or, you know, even like students will be like, but how much of that? Like, you knew some of that. And you'll be like, no, just like, you don't know. We really, truly don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, basically in my classes, I'm teaching song structure. Mm-hmm. So I'm teaching like the language of music more than anything else. Right. But I think that it's really important in terms of like, especially when you get to that stuck feeling, right? Of like, come take a musical improv class, because, mm-hmm. you know, it's not that there's no game and we don't ever talk about game. Like, game comes into play in a lot of different ways in musical improv, but musical improv sort of already has a game, which is it's a musical, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it takes some of that pressure off, and people say all the time that it makes their regular improv better. Mm. I think part of that is that we necessarily have to focus on cheating out, projecting, having a bigger energy, playing from emotion, playing from high stakes. Like, you can't sing a song if you don't have something to sing about. Mm-hmm. And there's a saying in musical theater that a character sings because their feelings are so big that the only way they can express them is to sing. Mm-hmm. And so that feeling of like heightened stakes, heightened reality is so, it's like from jump in musical improv. And people come into it just instinctually doing that. Whereas I think sometimes in improv, they, like, I think you talked about this, like, you sort of get that moment in your head of like trying to figure out the math and having all these, like, your tool belt has so many tools on it that sometimes you're in the moment going like, which tool? These tools? This tool? Oh no, I forgot my hammer. I forgot that, right? And so musical improv, for some reason, gets you out of your head very quickly because you know your scene has to have a song in it, so you play a scene that might have a song in it, and it's sort of like, it really stresses stage presence in a way that is, I think, really beneficial to improvisers. I think acting and performing and stage presence and all of that, I think you can be so good at improv and not learn any of that, and it can be really detrimental to your success at improv, you know? The people who are so funny, but they just stand there and talk. And you were talking a little bit about physical, like there's a physical aspect. There's the emotional connection to the music, to the, it's just gotta, it's a heightened thing already. And it's, I think that's awesome.
Yeah, there's a, yeah, I know there's a tendency where you can become either detached in a scene because you're going for the logic of it or the joke of it or something like that. And I feel like, yeah, with musical improv, there's, you don't have that luxury to do that.
No, because you have to sing a song. You can't sing a song about nothing.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, I don't know. I think it's so valuable. And they, you can take it after level two. And I think it's just like, every level two student after level two should come take a musical class either at the same time as level three and then go to level three. I just think something about it helps like release some of the pressure that I feel like people say that they get like when they start to get in their heads about game and all of that. And it doesn't mean that there's no game. There's still game and there's still, you know, working on good scene work at all times. It's just there's this other sort of fun thing that's going to happen.
Are there other musical, I guess, pedagogy or teaching that you've seen that kind of differ from your kind of point of view into how to teach musical improv?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think that probably everyone teaches it a little bit differently, just in terms of like what you, how you play. You teach how you play almost, right? Like, so like the, I play so emotionally and I play so much about, you know, relationship and feelings that I, that that's where I teach from. So I'm not great at teaching the stuff that's all about your premise and straight from, you know, really knowing what you're going to do before you do it. So I'm sure that everyone has a tweak on how they teach it. But in terms of like song structure, which is basically one of the things that we are teaching, that's like, that's not something we're making up as improvisers. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that probably different people teach it a little bit differently from me for sure. Like I really, really don't let people rhyme or I it's such an in your head thing to do. And then other people I think are really good at teaching rhyme and unlocking that in a way that isn't that important to me, you know? So sometimes I'll like, if I have a sub, I'll be like, do a rhyme, you know, someone like Zaccarino's great at that or like Ross Bryant is incredible at that. So I'll be like, yeah, do some rhyming stuff, do some rapping stuff, do some of the stuff that I can fake it a little bit, but that is not my wheelhouse completely. Yeah. So there's totally a benefit to studying with as in any improv, studying with as many people and getting a lot of perspectives and just acting and all of that.
Yeah, because I'm sure from if you make that like a solid thing, like listen, you have to rhyme or something like that, that's another thing that goes back to normal improv. It's like, well, now you're making it too mathy, which takes away
totally
the emotional investment. Well, in the,
and so often people will just make up a word in order to rhyme and it ruins the intent of what they're trying to say, right? So I have students I take away, I call it taking away their rhyming privileges. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to rhyme anymore. You have to say what you mean first before you rhyme. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who are masters at rhyming and saying what they mean. And listen, I can do it, but I'm almost always going to say something emotional or whatever first before I make a rhyme happen. Mm-hmm. So, but that's where that's my perspective. So someone else might think rhyming is super, super important.
Mm-hmm. Is there a point in your improv journey, especially now, like you've done it so long,
Yeah. You're
so great at it, you know what I mean? So it's like, I always wonder, and I'm always curious, when you have so much experience, and there's probably not a whole lot of people that have that much more experience than you,
Yeah. How
do you keep growing or keep that kind of energy? Is like, okay, how can I still expand?
Oh, totally. I think that Magic To Do has been really helpful for that, just because I'm in this group with people who are a lot younger than I am, people who are really fresh, it's sort of a nice combination of some people have been doing it a while and then new people. That's been really nice for me. Like, I see myself sometimes making moves that I would have made in my early days. I definitely think there's like a moment where in my improv where it's like, oh, I'm doing kind of the same 10 things that I know I'm good at. And I think that you said this in your podcast about the first year being so fun and crazy and you're taking all these risks, and then you sort of settle into a comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's like always trying to figure out like what is the new thing or the old thing. Like in college, I used to do a lot of pratfalls, which you can imagine was probably really so stupid, but I would like thought it was so funny and I would always get a huge laugh. And so like, I don't do stuff like that anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because I'm old, but it's like every once in a while I'd make a move like that or do something that it's like something I've never done before. And it's mm-hmm. like, I think that's what you do. You like keep trying to figure out what's a new fresh approach to this. And I think playing with new people is one way to do that. Mm-hmm. There's something to be said for just joining a group of people that you've never played with before.
Mm-hmm.
After Mother ended, I was on a Herald team for a year, another Herald team for a year. It was just because it was that thing of like, let's just like shake it up, get out there with people that I've never played with and see if it works.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have been thinking about like, it might be kind of fun to like take a class get back in a class with somebody whose perspective I know is really, really different from mine or plays really, really different from me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be really interesting and humbling to take a level 2 class at this stage.
Yeah. And that's always an interesting thing too. What's so fascinating about when I look at this community is like, as a student, there always seems to be a hierarchy and your teacher is like, oh yeah, you're kind of learning from them. And then it comes to a point where it feels like peers are teaching each other.
Mm-hmm.
So do you feel like you'd be able to like be in a class and kind of be able to kind of maybe put some of that, even ego or just your experience to the side and be like, oh yeah, this is, you know what?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I absolutely could. I think it'd be fun. I think mm-hmm. that'd be a really, if I had the time to do it, maybe I'll try and find time to do it. But having a child at home and teaching 3 classes a week makes it hard. But I think that would be probably a fun way to just like get shaken up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know, like this year I'm going to a few like festivals and stuff, which I haven't done a lot of in recent years. And I think that kind of thing is a good experience to see other people and experience other shows. And, I think you're always learning and always trying to get better for mm-hmm. sure. But it's easy to fall into the like, oh, I know what's funny.
Yeah.
I know the sort of my tricks.
Mm-hmm.
But I like surprising myself. I like doing, like I did something in a Magic To Do show. That's going to sound bad, but I wasn't intentionally, but I ended up playing a Nazi and I didn't do it. Yeah. I actually didn't label myself that, but I ended up being a Nazi and I just like totally embraced it in a way that I don't always, where I just was like, all right, then I'm going to sing about Hitler or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, I think it was really, really funny. And afterwards I felt like almost euphoric. Like I did a thing that I would not, that I don't normally do, So I think that kind of thing is like obviously keep surprising yourself.
Yeah.
Keep doing something you might not normally do.
Yeah. Is there, as a teacher too, do you notice there's a certain, probably a certain thing you know about, like, okay, how to get better at improv mm-hmm. as an improviser. Is there a different guideline to improve as a teacher? And what are those, what are some of those things that you found?
I teach so differently now than I used to. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I have found over the course of my career, like, I side coach. I almost exclusively side coach now. Like, and I think when I first started, I was like furiously taking notes during scenes. And then afterwards I would go after the scene, I'd go through all my notes. And I think that that's probably a pretty typical beginner teacher thing to do, to like really. And, but now I'm like, I'm always in the moment with them, and I'm always trying to like nudge and guide while things are happening so mm-hmm. that they can see, like, say yes right there, make that a statement, like, you know, and making those corrections in the moment so that I'm, you know, shaping them, constantly putting them right back on the path.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think like the more you do it, the more you, the better you get at improvising as a teacher, mm-hmm. at doing what the class needs. You know, seeing the class and going, okay, you guys get this. We could cut this a little bit shorter because the next thing is something you're struggling with and we need to spend more time on.
Mm-hmm.
And like trying to find those places where the class itself sort of breathes and you're improvising with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do that on a micro level and a macro level. You have to do that for a class, and then you have to figure out how to do that for each student, right? Because one student needs something a little bit different than another student, and so you're just constantly trying to pay it. It's like that thing where you're throwing the balls at each other, red ball, and it's like that chaos of like a lot of stuff is going on and you have to be able to stay focused on all of it, but mm-hmm. then also step back and see the big picture of the class. You know, and I'm also trying to always find the balance between encouraging what you're naturally so good at and also pushing you towards the thing that you're, that you need more of, you know, like you need to connect more emotionally, because even though you're kind of a robot person, like mm-hmm. connect more emotionally, you know, you're just always trying to find and unlock more and more potential in each student. And I have students who've been studying with me for 3 years, you know, who have been taking classes with me consistently, and the growth is incredible. The growth in when you see someone from where they started to where they are in 2 or 3 years, it always blows me away. It doesn't mean that even after 2 years of doing it, they are where someone at their highest level is, but they're getting better and better. And I have to believe as a teacher that people, that the majority of people can get better and better at it and can learn it. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah.
It's like trying to find that balance of like making you know what you're already great at, but also giving you the tools to be great at more.
Yeah. What was interesting was you kind of mentioned you almost exclusively side coach now. And it does feel like very rarely have I seen or have I experienced someone that does kind of both, as far as like lets you do the whole thing and then gives notes and also does a mix. It's usually almost either or.
Yeah.
Is there something that you found that students find more helpful with the side coaching, and how do you think that kind of shapes their learning
experience? I think they can see in the moment a real application of, if they make that change right in the moment, how it helps. So it's a balance for me. There are times when I'll let a scene just fail, just because sometimes that's the best way to learn why something works or doesn't work. So like, and as a teacher, I'm constantly having to make those decisions, like, do I stop this? And like, or sometimes I'll let it go and then I'll stop it and be like, start over with this in mind, or start, you know. And then there'll be other moments when it's like, just nudge that one moment, say yes right there, or yes, you do know that, or, you know, just make that a statement. Just that was a question. Say, restate it as a statement, you know? So I think that when they can see like right in the moment, like how the change helps is really good. But I do think that there are moments when you want to let them flounder or let them fail, so that later they can talk about why, like what, oh yeah, because I didn't do that and I didn't do that. So it is a real balance of those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't anymore say, here are the things you could have done. I either say, like, do it now, or at the end, what did you do? Let them tell me, like, what about that was not working? And then I very often will let them do it again with that in mind. Or, you know, sometimes it just fails and it sits there and they all learn from it and then they move on to the next thing because that's what they needed in order to learn in that moment. But there's like improv involved in teaching improv, you know? Yeah. So I think the more you do it, the better you get at that part of it.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything, because I know a lot of improv is taken from what you learn from someone else. I'm like, wow, that's a great tool. I'll use that to teach someone else or to, you know, help myself. Is there anything most recently that you've kind of taken from something else that you've learned from someone else and applied to? That's the first thing. And then are there new stuff that you found on your own? I'm like, you know what? This is something I see as myself. I haven't seen someone do this, but this is a exercise I think would help that you've kind of tailor-made.
Oh, interesting. Well, I don't know if I'm going to answer the question exactly right, but this is what you made me think of. I mean, I definitely feel like I'm learning, especially from some of the people in Magic to Do who just play they have a different skill set musically than I do, and I'm learning a lot from them, and I'm taking a lot of that into my classes with me and into my other shows with me. I recently taught a short form class, and it's not new, you know, and it's not something, you know, it's something I did 20 years ago that I haven't done in a really long time, but I really found a lot of value and applicability to long form in the short form that I was teaching. I was teaching at it was like a corporate thing, and I brought some of that back to my class, and it unlocked some things for me and for my students that was really interesting. And it was something I had not ever thought of. Like, I'd never really thought of in all my years of doing all this. I do a lot of corporate teaching. We do a lot of short form in that environment. You can't teach the Herald to a, you know, EMBA students. But, like, I was like, oh, this reminds me of group games. And and so I just made a lot of connections this past year between some of that stuff and long form that I think was very valuable when I brought it into some of the classes with me.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that answers your question, but maybe not what anyone wants to hear in long form conversations, but there just were some, like, for example, if the first beat of something just fails miserably, which, you know, I mean, I don't think that happens a ton, but maybe it does. If you're doing a Herald, like, what do you do in the second beat? Because you now have to play that thing again. Mm-hmm. Well, there was this short form game where you just replay the same scene in different styles, you know, do the scene normal, do it as a Western, do it as a film noir, do it as a musical, whatever. And I was just like, all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, that's what I would do. If my first beat failed, I would just replay it as a Western in the second beat, and it would make it so funny. It would make it have a game where it didn't have a game, but it also would still look like the same thing. I don't know. So it just had all these moments where I was like, you could game it, you know, you could make that game happen. You could decide to make it fun instead of trudging through something that wasn't working, you know? I don't know, I found it. I just, some of those moments that I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I never thought of that before. So I don't know.
No, that's true. I definitely get, because that's experiences that I think everyone has had where something doesn't work, but you don't have, you know, you don't have the tools to be like, okay, I know now what to do to make it fun in this next part of the.
Well, and sometimes the thing isn't fun, you know, and what you really want to do is just start over in the second beat. And it's sort of like sometimes, like, as a coach, I'm like, well, then just, I don't know, just start over. Yeah. I don't want to watch you be miserable for three beats. I don't need to watch that. You don't want to do that. Like, there's got to be some fluidity to it, right? Mm-hmm. Even the Herald, which has such a structure to it, it shouldn't be about not having fun, you know? And at the end of the day, if your first beat is just a brick that's laying there and you're like, oh, fuck, I have to go do a second beat. I have to go pick up that brick again. I don't know. Start over.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think you'll get, sure, maybe you'll get a note about it, but maybe if I was your coach, the note would be, I'm so glad that you found it, that you had fun in the second beat and didn't tie yourself to that thing that wasn't working, that mm-hmm. you knew wasn't working. Letting go of some of the pressure of it has to be a certain way. It's improv.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the beautiful thing. It doesn't have to be really any way at the end of the day. And if you're up there having fun and making me laugh and making each other laugh, like at the end of that show, so what if you get a note that says you didn't have a game and then you started something new? It's like, I don't know. I think people want you to watch you go, oh, I'm not bothered by that. Mm-hmm. I can do something different and something new.
Yeah.
People hang on to their bad moments in improv for a long time. And that's another thing I have never, ever struggled with, mm-hmm. ever. And that's one thing I'm constantly trying to tell my students and people you coach more than students, because I think maybe some students, but like, it's over. You yeah. did it and it's over. That's another reason side coaching is nice, because you're not after the fact going, here's all the things you did wrong or could have mm-hmm. done differently, because then it feels like a bigger thing. It's like if you're fixing it in the moment, right, mm-hmm. it's like not a thing at the end. Oh, I yeah. thought, I'm still thinking about that. But that's the thing about improv. Like, yes, we give notes, and yes, we have exercises and tools to get better at it. And the notes are important, especially if you have a consistent coach who's giving you the same note over and over again. That's important to mm-hmm. see that you do that you're in a rut or that you're trapped in this space. But like, in general, it's over when it's over. So I tell my students, if you don't have a coach there at the end of a show, get in a circle and tell everyone what you loved about the show. Mm-hmm. Everyone say one thing they loved about the show. There's no reason to end a show and talk about what didn't work. Yeah. It's over. That show, that's what we're doing. We're yeah. doing improv, you know? So I don't know. It's just, if you're beating yourself up about it, something that's not good. That's mm-hmm. not a good headspace to be, because you're going to bring that energy in the next time you do it. And you're going to play from a place of fear or a place of, you know, being mad at yourself.
That's interesting, because I remember starting off, there was, I think, one of my earlier teams, I think there was a difference of opinion of what we need to do to get better. Yeah. Some people were just like, hey, we already know we made mistakes. Let's just yeah. talk about how much fun we had and this and that. We know we want to get better, so we will get better. And
right.
then someone else was like, no, we really need to, if we don't really hone in on the issues that didn't work,
right.
we're not going to, you know. So those are two different thoughts. So that's kind of interesting. It seems like you come from the place of positive encouragement, especially with improv, because
yeah.
it's over.
Yeah. Well, I mean, listen, I think your coach is there to make you get better at the things that you're not better at. And I will say this, like, and hopefully I'm not contradicting myself, but when I start coaching a group for the first time, the first thing I do is have everyone say what they think their strengths are and what they think their challenges are. Because I think it's really important in a group that you're going to be in for a while to articulate to the group, here are the things that are challenging for me. Here are the places where I'm weak or that I mostly want to focus on, because the group does have to, the group is accountable to that, right? So the group is account, if you came in and said, I'm just not, you know, playing characters that are believable, then the group can help you be more believable, right? Mm-hmm. I think that there's value in getting better and knowing what your sort of what the overarching things are that are challenging you. But in general, especially if you don't have a coach at the show, I don't think that internally that you should go around and say, give each other notes or say, here's the mm-hmm. thing that we did badly. I just, especially right after the show, mm-hmm. I'll say to students, hey, listen, if I see you a week later, 4 days later, and you're still thinking about it, then we'll talk about it. But if you're right after the show and you've got all the adrenaline and all the whatever, it's just like so, it's just such a balloon pop to start talking about what didn't work. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to wait till the next rehearsal and then to say, here are the things that I'm still thinking about. Here are the moments that I want to talk about. So I don't mean that notes are not important. I just mean that, like, it's, you know, if you are someone who consistently beats yourself up after shows or is always thinking about what you could have done differently, mm-hmm. let it go. Mm-hmm. Let it go. Right? I mean, I've known people who they just like, oh, that was terrible. That was terrible. And they just do it so consistently that then I'm like, why are you doing this if you always feel that way? That's different than sort of pinpointing, hey, you guys, we seem to always do this. Like, we always take a knee in a group scene. Mm-hmm. Let's do something a little bit more, right? I mean, that's what Mother, that's why we created the sleepover form, is because we, the way that we were playing was just like so funny, but it was always, it always felt the same. We never had a show that felt different. We called it Big Bang, which was just, we would just run, game, fast. And it was an explosion. It was always really hilarious, but we wanted to do something different. So we created the sleepover form to sort of slow us down. Mm-hmm. And then after running that for a couple of years, we're like, oh, now we want something, we want a different thing. So then we created the soundtrack so that we had some, just, it was always like looking for a new way to play so that we weren't just doing the same thing over and over again.
Can you talk about the sleepover form and just how building that came about and what you found was so helpful just in your improv about doing that different form?
Yeah. Armando helped us create that form, Armando Diaz. And basically we, like I said, we just felt like we were playing really fast, hitting jokes and games really hard. And we wanted to slow down. We wanted to play characters. We wanted to be, I don't know. I mean, slower, more believable, more focused. And we, I think that we also thought like something sort of narrative based. And so we sort of, I think, started talking about the idea of just improvising a little play and like what that might be. And Armando worked with us and sort of helped us create this form that ended up being, you know, the idea was like each person. So I don't know if you like people on stage, like, so we all come out and we like freeze in a pillar. It's a little more complicated than that. But like, if you are frozen and I'm going to enter to activate you, I enter to activate you. But then you initiate the scene. So it's not me going up to you and initiating a scene. It's me going up to you and you initiating. So it's like an interesting way to, so that I couldn't come in with a hilarious joke. And also so everyone else on stage has to be prepared for whatever comes, right? And then each person, you know, do a bunch of two-person scenes where you establish characters. And then after everyone has established a character, you can start mixing and matching them. But you never play more than one character in a show. You always are playing the same character that you started with in your first scene. So it just was a way of really slowing us down, really making us accountable for listening, for creating strong characters with compelling voices. And it was so, so, so much fun. I mean, we really, like, we committed really hard to it. I mean, like I said, we were rehearsing twice a week and doing a show every week. And then for a while, we had a second show at an independent stage. So we were, like, we're watching our shows back on video with our coaches, you know, just, like, very, very committed to getting better and making this thing really, really good. And it worked.
Is it? Was there a difficult, was there like a growing period in the sense that we, you've already had this experience, like we know we're a really funny team, really good, but when we're doing this new thing, was there like a drop off and was it difficult to deal with that drop off?
I don't know if it was a drop off, but we didn't start doing it at UCB until we had done it for a while at sort of an independent theater and really workshopped it. So we didn't, you know, I'm sure there was a growing period of like, making ourselves do something really different than what we knew worked, you know? But I think that it, in general, Mother was just at a very, like, I think all of the teams around at that time, especially, like, there was a real confidence. There was no, like, struggle of, like, what, of, like, feeling like any of us went through unfunny phases. I mean, there was just all people who were really, really confident in what they were doing. So probably that was the hardest part, is getting some of us, because we were a lot of big sort of personalities and alpha players, getting us to just kind of like slow down and not play that way. But it, we all wanted to do it. It was something we all were very committed to doing. So it was, there was no resistance. So I don't think it was, I don't think there was any real drop off of any kind. So, because we worked so hard on it before we even launched it at UCB, you know? But yeah, I'm sure it was not the easiest thing to suddenly just like totally do a 180 on how we were playing as a group together. I think when we did the soundtrack, it was a lot easier just because it was like such a, it was, it, the actual form itself is the game, you know? So it's just a lot easier to like switch back into something that was a little more, it could go, like the scenes could go either way, depending on the music. It could be a slower scene or a fast pace or a silent scene. And I think that, it was a nice transition into something new and really different. But now we had all these things under our belts. Mm-hmm. There was one night where we did a Herald, like it was like all the weekend teams came and did Heralds one night. And we hadn't done one in years. And we were like, oh, are we going to be good at this? We did a 14-minute Herald. I mean, we nailed it. It was like, oh, that's the game. Okay, mm-hmm. we got it. And when, like, I remember like second beats, like there would just be one line. Mm-hmm. And then we would edit because the one line hit the game so hard. And I remember we were like laughing so hard. We were like, that's how we used to play. That big bang of just like, we get it. We got it. Let's move on. Got it. Move. Got it. Move. And so that's how we ended up doing like literally a 14-minute. And it was a full Herald with three beats, all of it. The games were really clear, but we were like, oh yeah, we do know how to do that. Because we had a moment where we're like, do we know how to even do a Herald? And we're like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
But we don't know how to be patient in doing a Herald, you know? It was really funny.
That's really interesting because every now and then we'll have just exercises just to get us to clue in on just the premise and stuff like that in Heralds. And we'll have like, okay, you're going to do a 10-minute Herald.
Yeah.
And we would do basically a full Herald in 10 minutes. Yeah. And we're like, just with that parameter, you realize how much stuff you cut out that you don't need.
Totally. I think that's what musical improv does, too. It does. There's something about when your brain goes, oh, it's going to be this, that makes you better at it when it's not what, you know what I mean? And then it's convincing your students, do that in the full, that's how you should always be playing. You should always be playing like it's a 10-minute Herald, but you just get more time than 10 minutes, right?
Yeah.
It like ups the stakes in a very real way.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting when I hear about just the kind of culture of how improvising was when you were like when you were with mother and all that stuff. It feels like number one, it just wasn't as big as far as just like where it was going. So just the density of it felt like everything was more dedicated. And
I mean, you know, we were like the 50 to 75 nerds, mm-hmm. improv nerds, right? I mean, or maybe there were 100 of us. Like when we first started, it was like, I mean, just to give you some context, when I was doing classes at UCB, my level 3 class became 2 Herald teams. And so, you know, 8 people became this Herald team, and maybe there were more than that because 2 of us got put on existing Herald teams. Mm-hmm. So, but it wasn't like there were not auditions. There was not, you know, it was like, oh, the level 3 class is graduating. Mm-hmm. Let's put some of them on Herald teams. Let's create a Herald team out of some of them. You know, it was just, there wasn't any like pressure. And I'm sure there were a couple of people who didn't get on Herald teams from that class who then just took level 3 again or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever they did, or maybe didn't take it. You know what I mean? Like in my memory, almost that whole class ended up on Herald teams mm-hmm. at some point, just because like Armando taught the class, he created the teams. He was like, okay, you 8 are a team, you know, Tara, you're on Mother, Ptolemy, you're on Neutrino. Mm-hmm. Like it was just literally like, boom, boom, boom. Okay. Now you're on teams. Like mm-hmm. that's how it happened. And it wasn't like that. It wasn't a big deal. It was, for me, it was a big deal because I got put on an existing team to replace somebody else. So there were shakeups. There were like, okay, you're coming off, or this guy left to go work on the Human Genome Project or what, you know what I mean? There were changes that like that. It wasn't like you're guaranteed to be on this team forever necessarily, but that was sort of a time when most of those groups are like never really broke up, that people left more of their own accord more often than getting removed from teams. So it really was just like we were the only people doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So we kept doing it. Mm-hmm. And then it just grew and grew and grew and grew, obviously. And now it sort of is what it is. And getting on a Herald team is obviously, as you know, it's like so hard. Mm-hmm. There's so many people who want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
is there anything else that you want to tell these people who love improv and any of your insights and experiences or advice or?
Yeah, I mean, I think I might have said this. I may have said this other places, but like My best advice is to play from love. Play from liking things and loving things more than dislike and problems, right? It's like people tend to want to create problems in improv to solve, or they want fights to have. And if you can sort of choose, listen, it's all life lessons, isn't it? But like, if you can choose to like someone instead of dislike them, or to love them instead of like them, do it. It makes your scenes so much easier and more fun, I think.
That's great. That's beautiful, too. Take that in life, too. Choose love, y'all.
Choose love. Thank you, Lawndale. It was so fun to talk to you.
Thank you, Tara. That was amazing. That was great. I learned a lot, too.
Oh, yeah. Please.
No, I did.
All right. Well, come take my musical class. You'd probably have a lot of fun.
I would. Because I love singing, but I feel like I can't sing.
Yeah, well, can I say this? This is what I say to everyone who says that. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be able to sing. You have to be willing to sing.
Yeah.
And I truly, truly believe that. Some of my very favorite musical improvisers cannot really sing. And they commit real hard to not singing, and I love them.
That's great.
I believe it strongly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to do that. And that was a long-form conversation. Tune in to the next episode when Tara Copeland will be your host.
That's me.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Peace.
Bye.
You've been listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at UCBtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy.